A little idle chatter about the people that we know. And though it doesn't matter, is there a different way of saying hello?
You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To subscribe to this podcast, visit www.questformeaning.org or search for Church of the Larger Fellowship in the iTunes Store.
Welcome to today's episode of The View. I'm Aisha Hauser and I'm in Seattle, and today we are continuing our series talking with the UUA presidents, and today it's the Reverend Gene Pupke. And we have Terry Bernour, and I'll let Tom and Terry introduce themselves.
I'm Tom Shade, and I'm a retired UU minister, and I live in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. And I also write a blog and The Lively Tradition. And I am happy to be back here on The View. I did 2 years of being one of the co-hosts on this, and it was a great, fun time. So I'm happy to come back and have a visit, especially see my old friend Aisha. And I guess Meg's going to show up eventually, but. I'm glad to be here.
Hi, everyone. So this is Terry. I'm a candidate for minister, and I get to be the tech support person for The View, which is pretty awesome. I will be behind the chalice for most of the episode, and I will also be live tweeting at CLFUU using the hashtag TheView, V-U-U. So please follow along and join in the conversation.
All right, I'm Clue now. I'm Jean Pupke, and I serve the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Richmond, Virginia, where I've been here for 11 years. I'm originally a New Yorker and presently deeply into my Virginia roots, which extend back here.
Hi, thanks, Jean. Well, glad to have you with us today. Here's a question I have been asking UU candidates. I know I've asked it to you before, and I'm always interested in people's responses, and that is that you are seeking powers and authorities. You are seeking, for example, as the UUA president, you have the authority to look someone in the eye and ask them for $1 million. You have the authority to speak on behalf of Unitarian Universalists everywhere. You have the authority and the power to organize and reorganize the UUA staff. Which of these powers and authorities are you most eager to have, and for what purpose?
I'm probably most eager to have conversation, not mentioned in the above. The president has a particular position in which they can initiate conversation with people. You can ask for groups of people to come together to discuss and deliberate and discern a problem. For some reason, feel like they should show up, which is great.
It's a convening authority.
It is a convening authority. And I think we have a lot of conversations we should be beginning. So that would be the first one that I'd want to use.
And what are those conversations you think are most important to have?
Well, I think we have a number of conversations that are appropriate to have, some of which are with the staff, with lay leaders in our movement, and with our professional leaders, to ask the question of what is valuable in your universe, what is helpful, what is something that can make a difference for you that you expect the association to offer. And we always start with those questions. That's the first thing we do. A second thing that I think is really important is to speak to the public about who we are in a comprehensive and easy to understand way that doesn't presume that this 10 syllable name of ours is easy. Mm-hmm. And I think we have some donors who have been helping us fund this proposition of ours. And I want to be in conversation with them, but I also want to be in conversation with some folks who have ceased contributing to our faith and find out what the genesis of that separation has been. And so I think there's a whole month's worth of good conversation to be had in July for whoever is elected president. And then gathering people in August and September and being ready for the board meeting in October.
Well, I noticed Meg has arrived. Hi, Meg.
Darn, Meg. We can't hear you. Ah. So, Jean, can I just follow up? Because sure. I appreciate your answer, and I think that is helpful. And I would, you will be wielding an immense amount of power and authority in this association. And so, you know, the president will, the president does. So I would like to hear if you, I'm going to give you a forced choice like we do with our youth. What, you know, which one would you pick and why? Because I think that is going to be a reality. So I would love to hear which one you would choose and why.
Well, Monday morning, I would meet with the board. Monday afternoon, I would call disaffected donors and major donors. Tuesday morning, I would be in conversation with different interest groups. The staff is on vacation after General Assembly, deservedly so, and so I probably would go lightly on intervening with them. So I think there's a kind of 1, 2, 3 that's been in my mind of who you're going to, I'm not going to leave New Orleans until I have good contacts with everybody working.
Do you want to talk about, you talked about fundraising and disaffected donors. What's your hypothesis going into that discussion? What are you trying to find out? What are you trying to verify or debunk in your own mind as to what's going on with donors?
Whatever.
No, everybody wants to be completely open-minded, but we're always we always have something that we're investigating.
I guess the question you always want to ask people is, what are their dreams? What were they hoping for? And the question sometimes is that we haven't articulated our mutual interests very well. People fall away sometimes because they aren't given attention. I grant you that can happen. But people also fall away because they're unconvinced that the money that they worked to you know, amass or whatever needs to be used well. And they need to be convinced that what they're thinking is valuable to other people as well. We have so many needs, and the budget of the UUA has been stalled for a long time. So we need a kickstart. We need to, not the online kickstart, we need to kickstart as in a motorcycle, get this engine running, and move forward, I think, on those things. Just to give you an example, our advocacy witness, SSL, our work with the College of Social Justice, with the UUSC. I think we need to sit and talk about where that works, how that works. We've made decisions in the past years, including to forego an office in DC. And how does that feel right now? You know, and how are we working together? How are the gears meshing? What is being dropped? And what needs support? And I think we need to have that conversation with our funders. We need to have that with our leaders. We need to have that conversation with our ministers. It's just really important stuff that we need to do what I would classically call spiritual discernment about where we're at and how we're being present. And I think if we do that, we're going to find that people discover their dreams in our planning.
There's so many ways at this point for people to give money to causes that promise to change the world. I mean, I think that as I look back, it seems that our UUA fundraising started to stall about the time that Barack Obama and progressive candidates started raising millions and millions of dollars from small donors across the country. And I'm wondering whether or not people are voting that is a more effective way or a more direct way to make the changes that they'd like to see, and that giving money to us is a little indirect way, which means that you have to make a different kind of argument. But so,
well,
I'm also interested in hearing what Meg has to say about our Washington office, but. Meg, why don't you ask a question about our Washington office that would be pointed and right? Oh, she has no sound. Okay.
Well, she could perhaps type.
Blink if you think it would be a good idea.
Didn't say I'd bring back the Washington office as it was. I said it's a question to be examined, though.
Well, you know, we try to push people into positions.
Well, I mean, you can push somebody into a position, but pride goeth before the fall. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously the best person you could have that conversation with would be Meg, you know? Okay. And so that's a conversation to be had.
Yeah, yeah.
Let me challenge you on one thing, though. You know, you're talking about our seeing the Democratic politics, perhaps, as a competition, or for that matter, independent politics as a competition for our assets. But I think I want to point out that it's really hard to, it's a different environment in which to raise funds when, you know, 98% of all the money that is made, all the wealth that is created, goes to the top 10% of the country. We have some people in the top 10% of the country, but we don't have the massive numbers of people who are in the top 10. And when they receive all the wealth, how are we going to grow the pool of money to be contributed anywhere?
Yep.
I'm proud that people felt active enough to have a lot of small donors contribute to politics when politics needed the contributions, and to have a different kind of fundraising, because particularly money in politics from large institutions is very corrupting. So we should be proud of that. And I don't think it diminishes our opportunity to raise funds. I think actually it's synonymous with it.
Well, I think that, you know, I push back. I'm not trying to set up a dichotomy there, but I am, or a contradiction there, but I am saying that there are more people, more opportunities to give away small funds to in people's Change the World budget. And I think that that's been a changed environment. And of course, the accumulation of wealth at the top has made the competition for an increasingly smaller pool. And so I think that's a part of what we're working with. How do you think we're deploying our human resources as the UU Association of Congregations, our staff? Do you think that they're deployed as they will? Do you think this the regionalization of staff has been a successful experiment? Do you think that it's past the stage of experiment and that's where it is at this point?
I don't think it's experimental at this point. It's a reality, and it's been some time since we had these discussions. The Orlando platform kind of kicking that off, and that was, you know, 6 years ago, I think. At any rate, I don't know if we have everything exactly right. We never presumed that we had everything exactly right. I think the Western region's preservation of their districts is a function of the large distances between them. Other people feel that it's not so much the question of distances as different cultures, because Denver is not San Diego, is not Seattle, you know, is certainly not Anchorage, and is certainly not Honolulu. So what's going on is people saying, whoa, it's going to be really hard for us to define mutual interest and collaboration across distance, across culture, across priorities. Did we get it right with five regions? I don't know. I could see some reason for making it otherwise, not the least of which is that any good HR director will tell you that 150 people is about the span, or 150 units is about the span of control that people can really relate to. And we have districts that have 200 congregations in them. So we really need to look at size and how that factors in. I'd rather have leaner districts in terms of the numbers of congregations and a clearer mandate to grow those districts and to or those regions and see new congregations be formed. You know, I think we could organize people more effectively if we said, okay, you're 120, what can you do in the next 10 years to found five congregations? And how can we help? What's the partnership there? What are we gonna do to make that happen? Another issue that's come with regionality is we've dismembered all those different boards, you know, 19 different boards, which we said was good because we didn't want dual supervision, which didn't really work. We didn't want everybody involved in governance all the time as opposed to other activities. But what we've also done is taken our somewhat informal and erratic school for leadership in some places, a place for post-board service, post-congregational board service, and a deep connection across the districts. You know, which bred a familiarity and a camaraderie. And we've taken that away and taken power out of lay leadership, I think, as a result. And I think we're going to see in 5 years a diminishment of national experience for folks. We're going to see people who served as board members and presidents who kind of are listless and not knowing where to go. I think that we're going to find that our insights are impoverished because we don't have regular input from lay leadership who are working with the board and others to create communities of accountability. So I'm concerned about that structurally. As a former HR person, those are the things that really get to me. I want to see a higher percentage of our people in the field, or at least in the field part of the time, because so much happens in congregations and covenanted communities that you can only learn if you are present. And traveling from one place to the next is, I had a job doing it once. I was the growth minister in the PNWD. And I got to go everywhere, you know, and show up and preach and talk. And I can tell you, every visit turns into a consulting visit. Every visit turns into a partnership, reaffirming. And I think it's powerful stuff. And we want everybody at the UUA to have a chance to be participating in that.
So can I jump in? A couple things. One is, you hit the nail on the head about the problem with now we don't have a mechanism for lay leadership on district boards, which I think was significant. And I originally hail from the Metro New York district, where we had district conference every year with 200 people that may never go to GA. And so that is lost, and that's a huge loss. And I hope that actually in 5 years, this will be different, because I'm hoping whichever person wins, that there's, I know we can't quite reverse regionalization, but at the very least, look at what are some ways to fix some of what went wrong. And the other thing, we are going to do a view about this at some point, I believe in April, all the regional leads are white, and that's a problem, because it is not empowering people of color in any way. And I just came back from Finding Our Way Home, the gathering underwritten by the UUA of religious professionals of color. And so I was, it feels like an insult to that group when most of the leadership, especially the face of the UUA Congregational Life staff, is white. So I just feel the need to say that. We will do a show on it. You don't need to say much about it if you don't want to, but it is important to lift that up.
Well, I think it's really important that we recognize the challenges that people of color who are professionals in our movement, but leaders in our movement, experience consistently throughout our movement. And there are barriers, there are unaware created barriers, there are standards that can only be derived from white culture alone. They're not multicultural, they're not welcoming. So we actually need a re-education. It's not enough to say, oh, we love having people of color come to our church, join our committee, pick up this representation of their race for us. That's ridiculous. That's so damaging. And we have to change the sensitivity, awareness, and practice we have. But more important, we have to step away from good aspirations and make a dang plan. You know, plans are what deliver results. And we need an HR plan that empowers people of color to succeed in a system that is welcoming to them.
And so I'm taking from what you're saying is that you don't believe that plan exists now.
I believe such a plan is implemented and accountably held. I would love, love the opportunity in place.
Interesting.
We know it doesn't exist because you just can look at the numbers. So that's all I'll say about it until we do the View show. Right, Meg?
Poor Meg. I know she wants to speak.
Let me ask you a question about, the organizations of people of color in Unitarian Universalism, which exist kind of outside, you know, the regional, the district, the congregational structure. They're organizations that are national or denomination-wide that have a particular identity. You know, they aren't on the org chart, the official org chart. what can you see doing as the UUA president to formalize relationships with the leadership of organizations of UUs of color to bring them into the decision-making process in a more substantial way, to bring them from the outside to the inside? And not that they're really outside, but they're not really inside, but they're in kind of a lobby area that's not really part of the thing. How do we change that? And how do we change? I mean, basically, the question behind that is that our official structure, congregations, the you know, on up, overvalues or over empowers white organization style and organizations.
Well, first of all, those groups exist in self-created safe space. Mm-hmm. And I don't assume they want to come when I beckon or perform when I ask, because that's an inherently racist kind of perspective. I want to ask the question of how do they see the UUA partnering with them? You know, it's true of our young adults and our youth that there are ways of processing, there are ways of leading, coming together, going apart, that aren't necessarily intensely membership focused, that don't have clear boundaries when one can say in, out, up, down. So one has to be in conversation. That's the real important thing. And for as a white woman, I found that being in conversation of accountability is where I'm at. I meet when I feel something is not working. I meet with people I think are affected, and I say, "I'm feeling that this isn't working. What are you needing, and how can I help?" And then I make promises that say, "Here's what I'm going to do in the next 3 months to do this thing." It surprises some people when I do that, but you know, one of the questions we have to have here is, what are the standards that we're using in our organization that in any way think younger folks or people of color or GLBT folk don't belong in these leadership roles? What's going on here? And it has to do with somewhat with hierarchy and organizational structure, but it also has to do with not creating a safe space for imagining. So when I designed this logo that we have for my campaign, you know, my intention was to say, you know, really, it's not about one person. It's about everybody coming together. What Wyman, the theologian, would have called concrescence. Adjective. That's where the beauty is. That's where the ultimate accountability is. And so how do we have conversations to ask the question, what are you seeking? And can we be in partnership in achieving some of that? We may not have remotely an idea how to make it all happen, but What's the next step we can take? And the important thing is to take the next step, not to wait for the whole big thing to become perfect, because it doesn't work that way.
You basically put this down to the ability of you to convene conversation as the critical step in resolving this.
No, I actually put it down to the other people's capacity to create conversation and me to listen. I think that process in the non-hierarchical areas of our faith are quite robust. I haven't found them to fail us. People are quite articulate about what they're seeking.
Where do you see the non-hierarchical parts of our faith? Because I don't see it in the UUA, but are you talking about like at the Black Lives of UU convening? I mean, where have you experienced non-hierarchy?
Yeah, I would say, well, there was a little hierarchy of Black Lives of UU, I thought, and that was appropriate in the places where I experienced it, you know. But it's with youth, people with a special interest who are organically working on stuff. We've got a group here that's working on sanctuary. It's very non-hierarchical. I haven't weighed in on anything or said, here's where we're going, march or what, you know. It's organically coming forward, and then they get to a point where there's some questions and we're in dialogue together about it, and we're, you know, listening to discover what does sanctuary mean for us in this place and this time. that's the way people work, the younger folks work. And increasingly, that's what we're trying to train elders to do. That's one of the reasons I'm running, is because I think I know how to do that. I think I know how to bring change about in a way that will be skilled and productive. And it might look for a little while where we're not getting something done, but then all of a sudden, pop, you'll see what results from involving a lot of diverse groups in solution making.
Meg asks, there's hierarchy and then there's just plain old the bureaucracy. What would you do to diminish the role of bureaucracy in UUism?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, if we, you know, the word bureaucracy in its origin meant the system by which things were more likely to get done. And in fact, you know that expression, good enough for government work? That actually used to be an accolade, meaning something that was good enough that even the government would be satisfied with. That was once true, okay? So so how do we get motion into the system? I think that's a really good question, Meg. One of the things is that our structures defeat what we're doing. We have siloed structures of function right now. This, for example, we have multicultural growth and witness here. And the real question we have to ask is, having it here, does that mean that other people don't think about the needs that we were talking about before to bring many voices forward? The notion of functionality is kind of an old way of thinking about organizational structure. How do we move from that? I think we reorganize into teams. We do some things differently. That's not hard to me. That's easy. I've been doing that all my life, putting those groups together. In the process, diminishing anxiety about change. When the people see that the change is needed because they themselves are part of the decision-making process, we can make change a lot faster.
Can I follow up real quick? Because I think one of the things that I have found valuable working in the congregation, and even at my time at the UUA many years ago, was there's value in having a collaboration between ordained and non-ordained ministry leaders working together. So right now, the UUA is very, very ordained minister heavy. And I think that's actually a loss in hearing voices of folks who came to ministry small m differently, whether it's religious educators, community organizers, what have you. So what are your feelings about that? Do you want to continue to just have ordained leadership at the UUA, or I would love to hear your thoughts on that?
Well, my sample says we don't have only ministers at the leadership level of the UUA. It would be correct for you to point to that in the field. But in the field, particularly,
the leadership council is a vast majority of ministers. I mean, the leadership right now are the vast majority ordained leadership. In terms of that's like numerical.
You and I, we need to talk about the numbers then, and you can school me on it. So, here's the thing, though. Okay, the need to connect with the congregation can't always happen through the minister, with the minister being the accent and pivot point of everything. That's unhealthy. I want to create consulting teams that go out to congregations who've invited them, that contain UUA people, but also contain strong lay leadership. This is part of how we can get folks trained and participating. And I think we're going to find on these consulting teams that some of the strongest people on the teams are going to be lay people who have a lot of great experience. I can think of phenomenal lay folks who've served in multiple congregations, founded multiple congregations. They really know their stuff, whereas a minister may have served once. So let's not name ministry as useful for being the best insight. Let's name ministry as valuable for being of service to congregations, community organizations, and that humility is a necessary part of that service, but also courage to move forward. I think in professional, generally in the UUA, courage is the differentiating factor between excellence in ministry and service or ineffectiveness. Will we move forward when it's hard? Will we move forward when the way is unclear? Will we move forward when there is a sacrifice to be made? And I feel that ministers hold a sacred obligation to keep moving forward, not all of which we always can do. Aisha, is that getting to your question?
I mean, I think part here's what I'm responding to. When I was at the UUA, like I said, maybe 7 years ago now, there seemed to be more of a balance of ordained leadership and non-ordained leadership in different areas. And I felt it was a very collaborative place. One of the more recent conversations I had with a colleague at the UUA, the person said to me, it has now that if you don't have a rev in front of your name, your opinion is discounted. This is within the organization because you will be leading the organization. This person's experience. So, and this is a person who's not necessarily, the person who said it is not on any kind of bandwagon. It made me really sad because I said, wow, that is not helpful to our, who we are as a faith.
So what we would do in that case, when we hear that kind of testimony, we check it out. We go deep and check it out. We ask folks, we create the kind of environment in which people can say, you know, it hasn't been working for me, or yeah, I really felt marginalized, or whatever. And to do that means to build trust. So, you know, if I were elected president, one of the first things I'd do is go out to one of those big tables at 24 Farnsworth, you know, and just plop down my computer and see who wants to come and talk. To pull people together radically, you have to show that you are accessible and that you are listening, and that when you can't make a change, you say, I'm not able to make this change. You are really radically honest. You're honest in how you evaluate people's performance. You're honest in working with team contributions. You do 360 evaluations. You really are radically committed organization better, and whatever's in the way is in the way, and you look to see if you can change it. And so, you know, if I were hearing that, Aisha, I would be saying, okay, let's find out more right away.
That's fair.
Meg wants to know about what you think about policy governance and whether it helps and hurts. And you've been on the board, and now you're running for the head of the administration, the staff. So you will have been, if you're successful, on both sides of this equation. So how do you think that's been working for us? Has it hurt? Has it helped? What do you think about the evaluation of programs as part of that? As part of the board response, you know, the relationship between the board and the staff.
I have a vision of how the president can work with the board that is a lot more interventionist than than we have been living out, probably. I see a much more dynamic relationship possible, meaning that
You said interventionist?
Yeah.
Just to unpack that.
Do you want me to unpack that?
Yeah.
Sometimes I see the president attending, sitting, and giving a report, and not commenting, or giving simply a heads up on what's coming down. I actually feel that the role of the executive in a policy governance structure is to be at the table, negotiating with the board, and sharing what they feel is really important that is going on. I feel as though very candid conversations have to happen. But above all, I feel like you can only have one set of ends, not a different set for operation. When I hear that the staff is working on dozens and dozens of projects at one time, I say to myself, wow, there's only five ends. Where are all those projects coming from? Mm-hmm. Focus is something, you know, that's very valuable in getting anything done. When you try to do everything, you get nothing done. And that's a fair critique of, you know, a lot of folks' experience. So to me, I'm so eager to do that work. Having been on the board and having been a part of the great controversy of 2011 and 12, mm-hmm. and been the person who went out of the room when there was an exercise going on and said, this is insanity. We keep doing the same thing and expecting a different result. And I sat down and I was joined by Donna Harrison and Jenny Corder, and I sat down and I explained I thought we needed to get a consultant in. The next morning, I proposed it to the board. I proposed a round number of $50,000 for those services because it was a severe problem. And the board affirmed it, and then I had a raft of negativity from the larger UU world, which complained about the amount of money we were setting aside, which indicated to me that either they didn't understand the depth of the difficulty nor the importance of the decision-making that has to go on at the board. And the board has to be radically committed to the agenda. So one good thing we did while I was on there was we shrunk the board. And I think the president needs to be there and leaning into the discussion. I look forward to working with the moderator and the board as a whole. And I envision being the person at the table doing that with them.
So your answer to Meg is that the problems with policy governance has been the a passivity or a lack of leaning in on the part of the administration.
The problems with the board, some of which have been solved. And I think any tool can be good or bad. It's, you know, I think this tool of policy governance makes sense at this level of our organization. And it requires some changes in function at the board. And I think we can do that. And changes at the UUA.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Meg, it's an area of emphasis for me.
When you say that there seems to be, you know, too many programs and projects for the number of ends that we have, and that what we need is focus. And, you know, my sense is that the older the organization is, the more it diffuses focus over time.
And I just and say authority. That
having ministered at a 225-year-old church, right? That, you know, over time, what we're doing, just everything adds on. Everything adds on. Nothing gets unfocused on.
Yeah, know, I'd like to change that.
Yeah, well, okay. How would you see doing that?
Again, you don't walk in and say, this is how it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
You ask the right questions of the right people, but you got to ask them fast. You can't wait long.
Mm.
And I have some hypotheses that I'll work on. And it's in fairness to a staff that I think is dedicated, works hard, loves the faith. They have to be in on the early part of the conversation. It's not fair to discuss people's roles and their responsibilities and then arrive with that baggage for them. Mm-hmm. So to me, inside and outside, board, advisory committees, everybody with staff having these conversations with maybe some facilitating help, I think that would be great.
Jean, we have a question from someone who's watching on YouTube. Takia Amin says, greetings to Jean. Wondering what she would do about ensuring that UUs understand the actual structure of the UUA. It's not very transparent or clear right now.
Amen. I've seen some renderings of the structure of the UUA, and they baffled me. They required odd sizes of paper and lots of energy to get them done. And, you know, I'm sure that it makes sense if you're on the inside. I don't think it always does when you're not. Therefore, I think that there's some transparency that is needed, where to go, who to contact, what's involved. Sometimes we bring the most detailed information up on the earliest pages of the website. People don't go fleeing into the night, I'll never know. And I think that, you know, having partners who are responsible to liaison is really important, especially to groups that have been historically marginalized. It's really important to have folks working across separations that once existed and pulling those folks together with bridge building. I also think, particularly for people of color who are not in congregations, and those people are many, it's hard to navigate. Congregations do provide a little bit of service in terms of helping you navigate a little bit, but how do people far, far outside navigate? How do we knit those folks in and let them know they're an important part of our faith?
One of the questions about focus that seems important now is that it seems that this environment that we're in now, the fact that there's a general entity out there known as the resistance, a word I haven't heard since I think 1969. What we're supposed to be doing, I think, is more up for grabs than oftentimes before. And probably if you dug into it, there'd be more differences of opinion within us, between folks who are, you know, seeing us as fomenting activism, people who see us as community building, people who see us as church building, church institutional preservation in this period of time. So what do you think the role of the UUA president is in the sorting through this question of how do we participate in the resistance in terms of, and in the context of everything else that we have been doing successfully and unsuccessfully for these many decades?
Well, if we could include with the resistance the capacity to renew systems, I think that our fifth principle advises us wisely that democracy is a valuable, valuable thing, and it seems to be under assault. And so people have committed to resisting the further degradation of our democracy. And we have to, in another way, you know, build up of our democracy. We're not one thing. We're not just political action. We're not just the public square. I did a new what we call pathways, but it's a new to UU class not too long ago. 15 people. The thing everybody was there for was community. They're already activists. And what they were finding was their taproot was a little thin, and they really wanted to be here for community support and to be with folks that they could talk through these challenges with. It's also true that we have institutionalists. I consider myself an institutionalist. Nobody serves on the UUA board and does all that extra work without being an institutionalist, and nobody builds up congregations without doing that. You know, we're facing a shrinking set of resources because the economy is shrinking the resources of the average person. You know, maybe less of a consideration for some of us, but it's a consideration for all of us. So right now we're running around trying to, you know, pick up morsels off the floor that are fight for 15, when in fact the minimum wage should be 20 something dollars an hour. We need to come together and use the strengths of institutionalists to build teams and use resources. We need to have community where we're strengthened. I don't forget to sing when we're going places that are difficult to be. We have to sing. And we need the advocates out there. I'd like to see if we could get, within 2 years, to have 100 Unitarian Universalists run for office, for school board, for county commissioner. I don't care what it's for. 100 UUs, let's, out of this 150,000 group that we have, let's figure out what 100 people should we madly support in their election process? How do we get them and our voice out into that community to preach the law of sanity, the practice of true democracy, and the moral call for all of us to abide by the rule of law and accountability and not make up stuff?
Jean, I want to jump in with a question from Lena Gardner. And she said, hi, Jean, wondering if you have a vision or ideas for the Standing on the Side of Love campaign, which right now seems to be our most visible public witness.
Yeah, I have to say I'm a little sad at the loss of Caitlin Breelove of that endeavor. I found her leadership to be very sound, and I hope that we will be taking care with that program. I'm hearing some people say things like, you know, it's kind of tired and everything else, but I say it has legs. We need to renew that. You know, I think we're at a renewal point, not a dismantling point. And I'm hopeful that that's the case anyway. I can't think of anything we've done in the past 10 years that has been more effective than, which was actually laid out by Meg and others. And I feel, you know, I'm talking to you and my screensaver's running, And it's full of pictures of people marching in yellow shirts, you know, and it's a habit now for our folks. And I get stopped in the grocery stores, the yellow shirt lady, you know. I say witness matters. Now, there are places and times where I wouldn't show up in my yellow shirt because there's a bigger purpose and I'm subsuming myself into that cause. But I'm proud of us for showing up. I'm proud of us for being there for GLBT folks and really making a difference. And we're not done there. We got more to do. I'm truly proud of the work we did on immigration. I feel strongly about it. If the DACA kids start to be really arrested, to be threatened, I'm going to prison. That's what I can say. And if in fact we, you know, we think that we can solve the rootedness of racism without showing up to push hard at certain moments in time, I can't imagine it's true. So I have three yellow shirts. I have a blue shirt from the early days. I'm ready to go. It's in my car. I'm ready to go. I even have a goldenrod collar that I wear, and it's not finished. We can do more. We're ready. We can be ready to go. And if you elect me president, you better buy a second shirt.
Will do. Another question from our listeners and viewers out there. Takia asks, there's a sense of sense that there's a growing antagonism toward the impact and reach of CLF, though many UUs of color find it helpful. Will you support the Church of the Larger Fellowship openly and other virtual ministry efforts?
I will.
Well, we're going to get done with all our questions in time, if you're that brief. Yes.
No, it's just not even a question. And in fact, okay. I want to help them with their prison ministry because they are carrying on behalf of the entire faith a very, very important ministry. We need to get them help to do so. I think CLF is really a powerful tool, but I have visions also for a much clearer, slimmer, sleeker UU channel that has captured things that we've done in an organized, searchable fashion. You don't have to go through every YouTube video to find it, to create a whole channel so that someone who's never heard of us before but just got off BeliefNet can really find really good information and can tune into our channel, but also that the most experienced of our folks can go there to do a deep dive on things. Every year, you know, Beacon Press publishes, well, they have published 25 books. Now they're going to publish 35, which is an indication of their health and vigor. And every time those authors go out and they do bookstore talks and they answer questions and we get to capture that and share that with folks. I think that's terrible. You know, we should build UU identity by reinforcing the dialogue many people are having many places and giving people a chance to weigh in. So for me, that antagonism, if it's there, shouldn't be there. It should be a collaboration to bigger and better things. And I think CLF has a lot of ideas of how we can do that. And they need to be on the inside of that conversation.
Thanks. That fits with the way I've been thinking about the CLF, but I love them. Someone wants to know about your views on community ministry and community ministers and their place in our polity and mission.
I wish we had more community ministers affiliated with congregations. For one thing, I think that we have people out there doing work based on our values, and we aren't always clear on how we can support them. And sometimes there's a notion that if they're there, they're supposed to support the congregation and relentlessly. And I think you have to have a balanced relationship. I've seen that achieved in many congregations. I like it. It's not possible at this time for us to do what some other faiths do, which is to support people in their community ministry in the way that, you know, Catholic social justice or Methodist women's activism or some of these other great activist groups do support that. Room to do that. And we've got a lot of young ministers coming through who feel that that's where their call is. So I'm challenged twice. Once is to help find ways to support them in that ministry outside of the congregation. And I'm challenged to say, how can we bring their ministry inside the congregation as an integral part of the work we're doing? How do we become forward-leaning enough to make their home a part of the work we do in our own missions?
I have a couple last questions for you. What has surprised you the most as you've campaigned for president?
I guess the thing that has honestly surprised me most is the lack of understanding for the situation we're in with regard to race, white-centeredness, and the question of, as I've been speaking with people, there's a lot of bewilderment still. And that is sad for me, sadder for other folks, I know, but we can jump in. In my own church, we've jumped in and created a program that's now blossoming. We just had 50 some odd people attending the training the other day. It's called Living the Pledge. And we know that there are multiple programs that are needed. All of them, though, seem to be arising outside the UUA. And so what I'm hearing from people is that, you know, there's no affordable options that the UUA is offering. And my assessment is that's correct. Yet it's possible to do, and I think it should be a very high priority. So that's kind of disappointed me a little bit.
And that's not only just in the fact that where the resources are deployed, but what you're hearing from people as you talk, that you're surprised by the low level of white people's understanding of white supremacy within the culture at large, within the structures of the society, and within the UUA itself and their congregations.
I think there's a lot of people who've made an intellectual commitment to resist racism. They try generally to do some practical things to evidence that. They are recognizing the deep systematic resistance. You know, the board, for example, has gone out on the limb. You know, last year at the candidate forum, I suggested that we do the present value of the 1968 unpaid section of the Bach Baba monies. And the board got out there and did it. Mm-hmm. We have the challenge of raising that money and more, I think, because we don't want to curtail any work we're doing there. But people have shared with me their unhappiness about this, their uncertainty about this. And so we need to really get clear and articulate, why did that happen and why is it needed? And to me, you know, that's not happening as much right now as it needs to be. I'd be on video telling the story right now.
My other question is, what has disappointed you in the campaign? And I think that's the question you answered. What has been your most pleasant surprise? We'll flip this around. What's the most pleasant surprise you've had in campaigning?
There have been a lot of pleasant surprises. I have to say, a couple weeks ago, I was seated on a dais looking out at the faces of the blue convening group. And it was, they were black faces that were happy. I had to stop and take a picture. It made me proud to find that there was a way that people had gathered that was meaningful and clearly delighting folks. And survivor instinct is there, right? We have many lessons to take on survivor skills. Mm-hmm. So that sort of thing pleased me. You know, interactions with youth have pleased me. I just recently was in Corpus Christi and was greeted as I walked in the door by a phalanx of youth in a church of about 100, probably 8 or 9 youth there to greet us. And I just, it made me grateful.
Well, I think we have 1 minute left, so I'm going to thank Jean for sharing with us her opinions and herself.
Thank you.
Through this interview, and I want to remind everybody that next week our guest will be Allison Miller, the third candidate. We already, somewhere out in the archives, there's our interview with Susan Frederick Gray. So come back next week to hear our interview with Allison Miller. Thank you very much to Jean and to Aisha, the always vocal Aisha, and the silent Meg Riley today. Isn't this remarkable? The silent Meg Riley.
Oh, we're
so glad that we could at least gaze upon her face today. All right. So thank you, everybody, we'll see you next week.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.